that it was a bad faith case based upon the alleged wrong and failure to pay the workers' comp benefits. Separate counsel was retained to represent National Union in that lawsuit. The original workers' comp trial went to trial in February of 91. It resulted in a jury verdict in favor of Mr. Haynes. And the following month, the judgment, payment of that judgment, and the release of that judgment was all affected. Subsequently, in this case, the bad faith case, CSI and National Union raised the defense that the release that was signed as part of the release of the original workers' comp judgment operated to also release the bad faith claims that were at issue. And in April of 1992, Mr. Haynes' lawyers took the deposition of Mr. Schwartberg, the lawyer in the underlying workers' comp case. Subsequent to that deposition, both CSI and National Union filed motions for summary judgment based both on the release defense and also based upon the contention that as a matter of law, CSI, i.e. National Union, had a reasonable basis to deny the claim based upon the medical evidence that was available to CSI at the time, and the motions did also cite some of the testimony obtained from Mr. Schwartberg during his deposition.
Do you agree with the characterization of opposing counsel that your motion for summary judgment was predicated at least in part upon the legal advice Mr. Schwartberg gave the insurance carrier?
As the motions were originally filed, Your Honor, it would be hard to disagree with that characterization because there is, I believe, in the motion a specific reference to the advice of counsel. I don't disagree with that characterization.
If the insurance carrier chooses to assert that as a defense to bad faith claim, as opposed to its reasonable dispute, why doesn't that open for discovery the advice that was actually given by counsel in the context of the workers' comp case?
Well, there are two answers to that. Let me deal with the hypothetical first. It may, depending upon what documents are asked for. If, for example, the carrier was subsequently served with a request for production or a subpoena to speak him that asked for production of all documents relied on by the attorney formulating his advice and communication of that advice to the carrier, there might well be an argument that would to be entitled to that. That's not the request that was filed in this case. If you look at tab G of the exhibits and look at the scope of the deuce of Pecum, it was for the complete litigation file, not just the things that may have been relied on to formulate the opinion and the communication of that opinion, but all files relating to the underlying workers' comp litigation.
But to fully test the expertise of that expert, that is the attorney you hired, and whether or not the insurance company was acting reasonably and relying on that attorney's advice. Might it not be necessary to see documents that the attorney claims he didn't rely on?
In a given case, it might be, but let me first respectfully point out that Mr. Schwartberg has never been designated as an expert. He is not designated as an expert in this case, and the other partial response to your question that also responds to the earlier question is that at the time the ruling was made by the court below, an amended motion for summary judgment had been filed, deleting any reliance on Mr. Schwartberg's testimony, and it was clearly represented to the court in the statement of facts at the hearing that both CSI and National Union were abandoning any reliance on advice of counsel defense.
And we have cases on offensive use of the privilege that says if the offensive use is waived at some stage in the litigation before it does any harm or has any effect.
It's National Union's position that this court's Ginsburg opinion deals with that directly. It's on the second or third page of the opinion. The court cites to Henson versus Citizens Bank of Irving, I believe it is. And there it says that a party may be put to an election whether to waive the privilege or abandon the claim. and that is what National Union CSI have done, and they did so before the court ruled on privileges in this case. We have affirmatively abandoned any reliance on advice of counsel and defense.
Judge Valdez couldn't have been much clearer than he was that he wanted you to index those documents that you sent her to him, could he?
No, sir.
And you just flat ignored it?
No, sir. I disagree with that.
How did you comply with his request that the documents be indexed?
In several ways. If you look at tabs O and P of the exhibits, specifically as to the correspondence file, there is a document-by-document index which specifically cites the privilege to each of those documents. Now, they claim that that's not a sufficient segregation and identification of documents because they think some of those objections aren't good ones. And we can argue about whether or not some of them might or might not be overruled had the judge looked at those exhibits. But there clearly was an identification of each of the documents, a specific identification of the privilege claim.
The judge apparently says he tried to look at them, but they were such a mess he couldn't make it out.
Well, and we believe that in arriving at that conclusion, that was an abuse of discretion by the lower court.
Other than the reference that you gave me at tabs O and P, was there any other segregation of the remaining documents?
Not to my knowledge.
Why not?
Because it was in his National Union's position that that segregation was adequate both to comply with what we believe the judge's instructions were and also to comply with what we understand the people's standards to be.
As to the bulk, though, of the documents that you tendered for the judge to look at, didn't National Union fail to segregate and index them?
Again, I have to disagree with that, Judge. If you look at item by item, each of the items that the summaries that are at tab O, I believe it is, it goes file by file and says, this is what's in the file, this is why we believe they are privileged, and in many instances, it even gets more specific than that. For example, there's one that says, this is the lawyer's trial notebook. It contains my impressions and putting the case together at trial. It contains my thought processes, my mental notes. This is the deposition of so-and-so. It contains my yellow highlighting, my colored tab markers on the pages. And to reveal it will reveal my thought processes in deciding what documents were important for the trial of the underlying case.
If the documents were not indexed, as the trial judge requested, do you agree that that should be a basis for denying the mandamus relief?
I think the standard ought to be that an objective one, that this court has to determine whether objectively looking at what was submitted to the trial court, whether it would be an abuse of discretion for the trial court to conclude that we did not sufficiently index the documents to comply with people. And I think that ought to be the standard.
I'm sorry, you said what would that, can you articulate that?
Yes, sir. The standard that I think ought to be applied by this court is that looking objectively at what was provided to the trial court, was it an abuse of discretion for the trial court to say that we did not sufficiently index those documents to comply with the people's standard?
Is that different from saying we disagree?
It is.
With what the trial court did.
It is, because if it is based on the objective indexes and documents that were provided. And the reason I say that it needs to be an objective standard is because, and this is no, I'm not casting aspersions here on the trial judge, but it could be that for whatever reason, as it was presented to a particular trial judge, it might not make sense to him. But it might make sense to another trial judge also looking at it. And it needs to be an objective standard. Did National Union comply with what people's required? It's our position clearly did.
Would the trial judge be within his or her discretion to at least say that as to those documents that you did not index, if there are such documents, that he wasn't going to give further consideration to those and provide those to counsel and focus our
review strictly on those that do have a clear index to them?
In your hypothetical, that might be appropriate. We disagree, of course, that that's the case here.
Does this court have any alternative in any case where the sufficiency of segregation, identification, and objection are raised as a reason for a waiver? Do we have any alternative other than simply to re-examine any documents with some standard that we set in mind?
Well, I don't think you necessarily have to examine the documents themselves.
We have to examine the indexing and the documents to the extent to understand whether there's a clear signal.
That's correct. And to the extent that the indices make reference to the documents and say, as they did in this case, that, you know, this is a deposition of so-and-so, it's got my yellow notations on it, it's got my color-coded stickies on it to indicate what I think is important, then yes, I think you do have to look at those documents. It is National Union's position that we did clearly comply with the People's Standard. People's set forth four basic requirements that need to be met in order to preserve claims of privilege. One is timely objection and statement of what privileges are being claimed. Secondly, a request for a hearing on those objections and claims of privilege. Third, evidence presented to support those claims of privilege. And finally, if it's necessary, a tender of those documents for in-camera inspection by the court. Mr. Haynes takes, the real parties in interest take exception to our position that we have complied with those People's Standards. First, they claim that we didn't sufficiently state our objection, didn't sufficiently identify the privileges claimed document by document. National Union disagrees both with the legal premise of that argument and also with the factual underpinnings of it, their assumption that we didn't sufficiently identify those privileges. There is, from the cases cited by both sides to the court, an apparent split in authority between the lower Texas appellate courts about whether People's requires an individual document-by-document statement of what privilege is applicable to that document. They cite the medical protective case, which has language in it to that effect. We believe that Green versus Lerner out of the Houston First District more appropriately states the standard that privileges can be claimed by categories.
Counsel, how long did you have to produce this? The judge talked about when he got back from vacation, but I couldn't tell from reading the report of the hearing how much time you have from the date of the hearing until you can drop these boxes off.
The original hearing was, I believe, July 2nd, and the documents were tendered for in-camera inspection, I believe, September 25th.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Okay, please the court. Mr. Greg Powers and Mr. Ron Koppel will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Powers, and I and my co-counsel, Rollins Koppel, are here on behalf of the real parties in interest, Jimmy Haynes and wife Elizabeth Haynes. We contend that these documents are discoverable for the reason that National Union has waived its privilege by failing to segregate the documents as authorized by this court and by the rules of procedure, that they waive the privilege by failing to present evidence to support their claims of privilege, that they also waived the privilege by offensively relying upon the testimony of their attorney in the workers' compensation case, which was Mr. Schwartzberg, and that they have made Mr. Schwartzberg a material witness based upon their affirmative defense that the plaintiffs have released their bad faith claim by virtue of a release of judgment executed at the conclusion of the workers' compensation case. In People versus the 4th Supreme Judicial Court, this court establish the procedures that are required to be followed by a party attempting to resist discovery. This court held that the party seeking to exclude the documents has an affirmative duty to plead a particular privilege or immunity, to produce evidence concerning the applicability of the particular privilege, and if the court determines that an in-camera inspection is required, they have the duty to segregate and produce to the court. Now, I disagree with counsel's statement that the indexing is the issue. The rule is Rule 166.4, and your ruling in Peoples, the issue is segregation. And I think it is clear from reviewing Exhibits O and P that there was no attempt at all on behalf of National Union to segregate clearly non-privileged documents from documents that presumably could have a legitimate claim of privilege.
Well, how can you segregate non-privileged documents from privileged documents? You're supposed to produce non-privileged documents, not just segregate.
Well, Your Honor, when they tendered for
Isn't that right? Don't you produce the non-privileged documents?
You produce the documents that you claim to be privileged, Your Honor.
Well, then there's no way to, if you claim they're all privileged, there's nothing to segregate.
Yes, sir, but I think it is obvious from reviewing Exhibit P that there were clearly documents that anyone would recognize as being not privileged. The very first page of Exhibit P is correspondence from the plaintiff's attorney to the defendant's attorney forwarding final judgment and approval and execution.
Were there any objections?
You say that's clearly not privileged.
Yes, sir. I claim it's clearly not. They claim it's an attorney-client communication, a communication between myself and the attorney handling the workers' compensation case. I don't see how that could possibly be a claim of privilege.
Was there any objection to that on the basis of relevancy, immateriality, or that you already had it?
No, Justice Phillips, there's not. And in addition to that,
I'm not sure quite how that helps you to get another copy of the letter.
Sorry?
I'm not quite sure how it helps you to get another copy of the letter you wrote to the opposing counsel. And I'm not quite sure how that's going to advance
I understand, sir, but it is obvious from these exhibits that what they did was they dumped the entire files on this trial court. They attached.
But that's what you. I mean, you asked for everything. You asked for that was your request. The whole attorney-client.
We asked for the litigation.
The litigation file.
But the trial court ordered that the privileged portions of that file be. The trial court did not want to see the entire file. It wanted to see the sections of that file that were clearly privileged or with a legitimate claim of privilege. Not things such as the plaintiff's answers to interrogatories or correspondence between the defense attorney and the district court.
What you were asking for, then you say, or what the trial court ordered when you asked for the whole file, is those parts of the file which would ordinarily be covered by attorney-client privilege or work product, but to which you felt there was an exception because of either their offensive use or their defense that the contract waived your right to pursue bad faith claims.
We were claiming, we wanted them to tender for in-camera inspections the portions that they claimed proved so the court could see whether or not that our argument of offensive waiver applied to those documents. The issue of the release of judgment replied to documents concerning the instructions he may have received from his client regarding the intentions of the release of judgment, things of that nature. Yes, sir.
Mr. Powers, isn't there a difference between failure to segregate and perhaps what you might argue a frivolous objection to the trial court sanction short of declaring a waiver?
Well, Justice Cornyn, we contend that under Peoples, the segregate means to limit out, to put before the court the documents in an organized fashion so they can tell what is, make a determination and to provide sufficient evidence to make an intelligent decision as to whether the privilege applies to that particular document.
But if they claim the file is privileged, that's their claim.
That
may not be right, but if that's their claim, what else is there to segregate?
Well, Justice Heck, it's our position that, and I think the law in Texas is clear, that just because a document reposes in an attorney's file does not mean it's privileged.
I certainly agree with that. But if the claim is that what's in this file is privileged, what else is there to segregate? That may be a false claim. Maybe the trial judge should overrule it, but what else is there to segregate?
Well, if they're making that claim, then the segregation should still be made with regard to the particular privilege attached to the particular document, which was not done in this case. The only file contained, or obviously we haven't seen these files, but there's presumably numerous files in these two boxes. And the only file that appears to have any sort of indexing at all or a privilege associated with a particular document is Exhibit P, which is 200, is the correspondence file in the Trump case, and there's 274 documents in there.
You say indexing is not the issue.
Indexing is not. I contend that they had a duty to segregate the privileged from the non-privileged documents when they tendered them to the court. If they don't, I think the trial courts in this state are going to have an unreasonable burden. They're going to be unable to protect themselves from attorneys who dump boxes of documents on them, claiming that they're attorney-client privilege, and then requiring that judge to go through and determine on his own whether documents such as answers to interrogatories in the underlying workers' compensation case are attorney-client communications.
Is there any reason to treat attorneys' files separately?
In this case, there's not, because they're offensively relying upon these attorneys' files.
They've abandoned them.
That's not correct, Justice Heck. There were two hearings. There was a hearing on July 2nd, 1992, and also on November 24th. On both of those hearings, the National Union's motion for summary judgment was before the court. It was not until this mandamus proceeding, the day the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi refused the writ. It was on that day that they filed with the district clerk's office their amended motion, deleting all reference to their attorney's comments.
If it were amended, would there be any reason to treat these files differently?
Yes, sir, because I think they've still made this file an issue because they're still relying upon the release. And not only that, but the law is clear that the reviewing court in a mandamus proceeding has to look at or must consider the record that is before the trial court. A mandamus proceeding is not a trial de novo. And before the trial court on that particular day was the motion for summary judgment as stated. And they also, they claimed that they didn't designate him as an expert. Well, they designated him in interrogatories as a fact witness. And they also designated him in their motion for summary judgment. Article 13, entitled Experts' Opinions Also Form the Basis for Reasonable Controversy. In there, they state that portions of the Scott Schwartzberg deposition established after the verdict that the Haynes claim was questionable.
Are there?
So they've indicated. I'm sorry.
Is there any question that the claimant's attorney's file would also be discoverable in this case?
That the claimant's attorney's file would be discoverable?
So what his view is releasable?
I think the issue in this bad faith case is set by Aranda, and that is what National Union knew or should have known at the time they denied this claim. That is the issue, and that's the claimant's burden.
But if the
claimant, I think that's why
the claimant thought that the release was what the National Union thought it should be, shouldn't the claimant's attorney's files be discoverable?
Portions could be discoverable, I guess.
And if they ask you for the whole file, then you've got to go through there and mark whichever document.
That's the way I interpret People versus the Fourth Supreme in Rule 166b4.
And if you leave a document in there that's clearly not privileged, and the judge finds it, then you waive the claim of privilege as to the whole file.
Basically, Your Honor, if they don't segregate properly, I think there is that they have waived the trial court's action as this court established in that case.
Why would you not always ask for the attorney's files in every case you file?
Because they're not relying offensively in most cases upon the attorney's opinions and advice.
Well, if you were creative enough to think of a reason why there might be something in there that was relevant, why wouldn't you ask for the file, hope that the lawyer didn't segregate, quote unquote, or index, quote unquote, or do some other procedural thing to preserve the privilege, hope that there was something in there that wasn't privileged, and when the trial judge found it, say, it waives the whole file.
Justice Heck, in this particular case, they have made this file an issue. This is not a typical case. They have made this file an issue by, on examination and during his deposition, asking him specific questions and then taking those excerpts and using those to support their motion for summary judgment.
If they waive it orally in this court, you heard counsel's argument just before.
Yes, sir.
And if they say they're not relying on advice of counsel, they say that in this court, isn't that pretty effective?
No, sir, it's not. Because what is to preclude them from going back and amending their motion again? And the truth of the matter is before this trial court was that motion that has all these references to 28 excerpts from his deposition.
And you think if you typed up the transcript of this argument and took it back down to the trial judge and say, see right here, judge, they waived it, he's going to say, well, that's not good. What would it take to waive it?
What it takes to waive it, Judge, is what they did, and I contend that...
No, I'm sorry. What would it take to waive reliance on advice of counsel as a defense to this suit?
I don't think there is anything that they could take unless they withdrew their issue on the release of the judgment, the release of judgment that they claim releases the bad faith claim. Mr. Schwartzberg,
can't they make that argument just based on the plain language without anything about what anybody had in their mind?
Justice Phillips, under mutual mistake, the intent of the parties and the knowledge of the...
You don't have to allege mutual mistake in every contract.
Well, but we are contending mutual mistake in this particular situation because...
You're contending mutual mistake.
Yes, sir. And those files...
So if you contend mutual mistake and they say, no, it's plain on the face of it, then you get to look at the other side's file, attorney's file, to understand whether or not you can make your proof of mutual mistake.
Justice Phillips, I think this goes to exactly what the Ginsburg rule said. I don't think it is against the rules of fundamental fairness to allow National Union to assert a release of judgment stating that we released our bad faith claim and then deny us access to the very files that their attorney relied upon and utilized in constructing it.
It would always be nice to see what, in any contract case, to see what the attorney and the client talked about when they were drafting.
There's one particular distinction here, and that is Mr. Schwartzberg, who was also denied access to his files at the time of his deposition, testified that there very well could be documents or memorandums in his file that would pertain to instructions he was giving concerning the release of judgment. At this time, I'd like to defer the rest of my time with your permission to my co-counsel.
Well, I have one more question.
Yes, sir.
I just want to get the chronology right. You wanted a certain narrow category of information in the attorney-client files about this drafting of this release.
That is one of the items we wanted.
Well, what else did you feel you had a legitimate interest in that might be protected, that would ordinarily be thought of as attorney-client?
Mr. Schwartzberg testified that based upon the medical evidence in his file, that they had a reasonable basis to controvert the claim. He testified that based upon the underlying investigation file that he reviewed and had in his files, they did not contain any document that would lead him to believe the case was not defensible or that it shouldn't be controverted, that the claims file that he had showed that there was clear disputed liability. All of these items...
So you wanted work product and attorney-client privilege.
I'm sorry?
You wanted certain items in there that related to work product or were privileged by, or were attorney-client communications. For really two areas. One is the whole bad faith defense, and the other is what they meant when they drafted the release. And to get that, you asked for the entire litigation file. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, because it was obvious after his deposition that he relied upon those files.
So you asked for everything, knowing that a lot of this was, I mean, when you asked for an entire litigation file, they would have to produce your correspondence back and forth.
We asked for the Hirschgruber litigation files, including, not limited to,
I'm confused or wrong. Did you ask for the entire litigation?
Yes, sir, we did.
Okay. And then they made no objection to that request that, wait a minute, part of this has already been introduced in trial. Part of it is documents that the plaintiff's attorney himself generated. Their objections were solely work product and attorney-client privilege. Is that right?
Their argument, Judge, is that the files are their attorney's files and they are constituted work product.
Any other questions?
They didn't have an objection that the request was just overbroad.
No, sir, they did not. It was that it constituted their attorney's files and they were attorney work product.
Mr. Powers, isn't the insurance carrier in a bad faith case always going to rely at least in part on the attorney-client communications by the lawyer they hired to represent them in the underlying case, whether they claim that they use it defensively or not?
I would presume that so, sir, but in most cases they don't attach the excerpts from their counsel's opinion in support of the motion for summary judgment as the primary basis to support that position of summary judgment, which was on file before the trial court.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, please, Court. My name is Raleigh Koppel. It's always a thrill to be here, even when you'd rather not be here. you know, it seems to me there's a lot of that this is a very important case. Counsel mentioned there's a split authority as to what type of indexing is required in Peoples, and he relies on Green versus Lerner, and I'd like the court to look at that case and see what the court was really dealing with. The court commented in that opinion, said, we have reviewed these documents consisting of a small packet of attorney's notes, and we've determined that the court was right when he held it that it was protected as attorney work product. And another connection said, we have also reviewed certain documents, which were obviously segregated, which do reveal experts' opinion called as consultants. You know, the case is entirely different. But if you look at Rule 166b-4, and you look at Peoples, and you look at all the cases dealing with this, you know, the basic principle is you're supposed to educate the trial judge. You're not supposed to obfuscate. You're not supposed to try to hide the football. You're not supposed to lead the court into error. You're supposed to help the court. And Judge Valdez knew what he was going to be faced with in July. And he stated very carefully, said that he wanted to be spoon-fed, for lack of a better word. Says, I guess anticipating a lot of documents were going to be submitted for my inspection. And about a month ago, I attempted to decipher. This is in when he finally came down with his ruling. I attempted to decipher, to go through the boxes. And again, I became frustrated, for lack of a better word, and I just dropped it. But he said this, and I think this is important to this court. I have attempted in good faith to review for inspection all of the documents. But I've been unable to do so because of the manner in which they are presented for my consideration.
Mr. Cobb, let me ask you, going on that.
Yes, sir.
Looks like Mr. Powers has his briefcase back there, and I'm assuming he's got a bunch of stuff in that briefcase. And Mr. Ross stands up here and says, Judge, I want him to produce that briefcase. And Mr. Powers comes up and says, Judge, attorney-client privilege, work product privilege. My guess is there's going to be something in that briefcase. Maybe there's the Texas Rules of Court. Maybe there's a little flag on one of the pages on an issue that he thinks is relevant to this case. Well, obviously, this document is not a privileged document, but it does represent the work product because it's a part of his thinking about his argument that would be clearly privileged, not discoverable.
Your Honor,
your trial judge would look in this box, and I'd say, Judge, this briefcase is protected by the attorney-client privilege and work product, and the trial judge would open it up and say, well, I see this in here, that's not privileged, and I see something else in here, and that's not privileged. Couldn't it very clearly be the trial judge can't make heads nor tails of it because they're just simply notes to the lawyer himself. It may have no meaning to anybody else looking at it except the lawyer. And the only thing that, what can the trial judge effectively evaluate, and what can the lawyer be expected to do to enlighten the judge in terms of got to look at every piece of paper and explain what this means to me, the lawyer, before he can, doesn't the problem come about from not requesting information contained in the file, but simply requesting the file? Isn't that where the problem comes from?
Well, Your Honor, we started out by requesting documents relevant to the release when we took Mr. Schwartzberg's deposition. And in this connection, I believe Chief Justice Phillips asked the question, well, wouldn't it be true in any case where there was a dispute about a contract that you could allege mutual mistake, just simply allege it, and get access to the attorney's files? And we say no, that obviously, as we all know, in order to get to mutual mistake, you have to first find that there's an ambiguity. Now, in this case, we're dealing with something that says up at the top, release of judgment. We're talking about a situation where there was a jury verdict totally permanent. They decided not to appeal. And after the time for appeal had expired, they sent us a check to pay the judgment, no additional consideration, bold-faced type up at the top, release of judgment. You know, obviously this is what we thought we were dealing with. Buried down there in the boilerplate somewhere, it says all other claims, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, this could not have been intended to release the bad faith case, which was a separately docketed, had another style, another cause number. And Mr. Schwartzberg admitted that he would have used a different form for that. You know, we're dealing with a situation that literally screams mutual mistake.
Counsel, you mentioned Judge Valdez's frustration at trying to perform an in-camera inspection of these documents, but I dare say that most of the trial bench in the state of Texas is frustrated with the requirement of having to perform in-camera inspections as a general proposition. Is there any difference between document production like this involving an attorney litigation file and the standard we ought to apply if a couple of boxcars of documents are produced? I mean, is there any counsel proposes we have some objective standard?
Justice Cronin, I think we're going to have to go back to the basic principles that Justice Doggett was talking about in State versus Lowry, and incidentally, most of it is not original prose by him, but it's borrowed. You know, we start with the proposition that it's long-standing tradition that the purpose of discovery is to promote a fair resolution of disputes, and that we have to handle all of this with common sense. Frankly, I would be embarrassed to go before a district judge, and I know probably at least four or five of you have been district judges, who I have to practice before every day, where the judge said, please do not dump all this stuff, but give me some guidance. I remember I served on the first pattern jury charge committee when we started, and there was no guidance at all until we had our pattern jury charges. But it's always been the law that if you're going to make an objection, your objection has to be enlightening to the trial court.
Well, he said
otherwise it's not considered to be.
He provided some guidance with this index that's found at tabs O and P.
I'm sorry, Judge.
As I understood his response to my question, he said he did respond to Judge Valdez with the index that is at tabs O and P. I've not looked at it yet.
Your Honor, we will rest our case. If you look at it, if you feel that enlightens anybody to any extent, then perhaps Judge Valdez was wrong. But we submit that it does not. It's just an itemization of what's in the file, and that's in Exhibit P and Exhibit O. It simply identifies the different files that were presented. And we say that this violates the policy of openness that we're supposed to be dealing with. Look, we're faced here with two complete defenses. One, the defense of the release, which constitutes a complete defense if it's valid, and we have to defeat that by showing that there was a mutual mistake or a unilateral remedial mistake, or of course we're going to argue that the contract should not be construed to even cover the bad faith claim. If the court holds that's true, then none of this is relevant. But if the court sees that there is something to their argument, that is that the release does create an ambiguity as to whether it was intended to release the bad faith claim, then we get into the question of whether there was mutuality, whether there was consideration, whether there was a real intent to do this. And the second thing we're dealing with is whether the insurance company at all times, they filed an affidavit that said between July of 1987...
Since your time has expired a good while ago, can you make this very short?
They say you have to pay a claim when you know it's owed, regardless of whether there's a lawsuit going on or not. And we say that by filing an affidavit that at no time did they discover that the man was even entitled to medical bills being paid or an MRI or anything else, that they opened the door, certainly, as to what they really knew. How are you going to prove what's in the corporate mind if you can't get into the corporate files?
Corporate attorney's files.
Well, we're talking about the corporate files, Your Honor.
Litigation files.
Well, in connection with their reliance, we say that Scott Schwartzberg is a witness. Justice Gonzalez wrote an opinion in the Axelson case, which we refer you to.
We would all know a lot more about every client if we could look at his attorney's files.
But Judge, that would not be proper. But we say that in a bad faith case, where they were obviously relying upon this man for advice, and they have admitted it, and they can't say, well, we're just going to withdraw, and we say that's a whole lot like the Axelson case, where they attempted to say, well, we're not relying on the chief engineer who may have been responsible for this explosion, and therefore you can't get everything he does is work product. They tried to shield that by saying he was a consultant. You can't do that. This man was in this thing all the way. And we say that we're entitled to know what was in his mind and what was revealed to him by the insurance company.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, are these two boxes up here in this court?
To my knowledge, they have been transmitted from the Court of Appeals, Judge. Let me try and briefly address about 4 points quickly in rebuttal. First, the question of whether or not we have waived advice of counsel defense concerning the reasonableness of the denial. I'll just simply refer the court to page 16 of the transcript from the November hearing, where it was specifically stated to the court that the amended motion had been filed that morning. It says, and I quote, "We are not going to rely on the deposition of Scott Schwartzberger as an affirmative manner." It goes on further down the page to say, "We are not going to rely on that. National Union or CS Corporate Services are going to rely on it." That was at the November hearing. Secondly, we just simply flat out disagree as to whether or not these documents were or were not segregated. The question over here earlier, whether there's a difference between not segregating and claiming privileges that turn out to be incorrect, is exactly on point. There was not a single document submitted to the trial court for which a privilege was not claimed. Not a single document submitted to the trial court for which a privilege was not claimed. Now, we may disagree about whether some of those privileges and objections were valid or not, whether or not they should be overruled.
So it was not your feeling that they asked for anything that was irrelevant or immaterial?
No, and let me answer that. No question that just because a document, otherwise not privileged, comes into a lawyer's hands, that it suddenly becomes privileged in the lawyer's hands. We don't dispute that principle of law for a minute. But the point that neither the trial court nor the real parties in interest have ever come to grips with in this case is the body of law that says the lawyer has the lawyer's organization of those documents and his selection of documents otherwise not privileged to put them in his trial notebook or to yellow highlight a pleading that may be on file down at the courthouse or to make notations in the margin of interrogatory answers that are matters of public record is his work product. And there are cases which I'll be happy to provide to the court in a supplemental submission on that point. The leading one is a federal case, Sprock, SPR, OCK versus Peel, P-I-E-L, 759, Fed Second, 312, Third Circuit opinion from 85. Third, on the question of whether or not there's been a waiver on the release language, relying on a release is not an advice of counsel defense. It is a defense based upon the language of the release and the fact that they may want to claim mutual mistake. That's them trying to put that issue, put that matter into dispute. Reliance on that release is not an advice of counsel defense.
Do you believe that if they plead mutual mistake, that they've waived the attorney-client privilege to the extent that you might want to look at what their attorney advised?
If they plead it and they put it in issue, yes, that conceivably could be requested. Let me give the court one, of all the cases we've been talking about, unfortunately, there's one discovery case that does involve the production of a lawyer's litigation file that unfortunately was not cited by either party in its briefs. It's Parten, P-A-R-T-E-N, versus Brigham, 785 Southwest 2nd, 165, Fort Worth case, 1989. And that provides, I think, some interesting analogy to this case. In that case, there was an advice of counsel issue placed before the court by the plaintiff. The court ordered the disclosure of the attorney's complete litigation file, and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals said, no, that's overbroad. Even in those circumstances where an advice of counsel defense is relied upon, it's only those documents that relate to that defense that you're going to be entitled to. And it's absolutely overbroad to require the production.
But you made no overbreadth objection.
I'm sorry?
You made no overbreadth objection on the trial court.
No, but that doesn't waive the privilege objection as to the rest of the documents. What the Court of Appeals said in that case, that to order production of the complete litigation file was improper because the file necessarily would contain privileged documents that didn't relate to that issue.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
You say you posed you argued a privilege as to each and every document that was in the files that were submitted to the court, to the trial court?
It is our contention, let me make that perfectly clear. There was no document in those two boxes submitted to the judge for which a privilege was not claimed.
For which privilege was not claimed. Well, let's take the example, and I hope I recall it correctly. It was a letter between counsel, a letter to opposing counsel, forwarding a draft judgment, if I recall correctly. What privilege would cover that one?
Well, there are two responses to that. If it was the letter itself that was sent to counsel that's in his file, certainly that is a matter of public record, it's disclosed to him, it's not privileged. But what if that letter contains marginalia, where the lawyer made notations to himself on it when he sent it? That's his file copy. So that's a specific example. I mean, in relation to the deposition.
Well, would that have been the privilege claim for that particular piece of correspondence and the attachments or the contents or attached contents that it was transmitting? That there were lawyers' notes on there, counsel's personal notes on there, and it's not just a copy of a letter?
It might well be. First of all,
what if there are no notations on it? What privilege would
If there are no notations on it, if it's just a plain carbon copy of what was sent to him, then that objection ought to be overruled. But the fact that objection ought to be overruled is not a waiver of privilege as to the entire file.
But it would clearly not be privileged, would it?
That document might not be, and in that case, that objection, in your hypothetical, that objection ought to be overruled, and that document ordered produced.
If you have files that are submitted to the court that are replete with this type of frivolous claim of privilege, what is the court to do?
The court has the power to deal with the attorney who does that through appropriate sanctions.
There's no waiver.
But it's not a waiver. It's our position.
The court's got to jump the hurdles and determine what's privileged, what's not, and wade through all of this without any help from counsel. And there's still no waiver on the part of counsel for not dealing with integrity with the court.
Well, to the extent your hypothetical assumes that there was no help provided and that there weren't indices provided, I have to disagree with the hypothetical because there were in this case.
Well, I'm speaking hypothetically.
Any other questions?
What's your fourth point?
The last one I wanted to address was the one you raised. Should attorney files be treated differently? And it's our position that the answer is clearly yes. I will tell you from my own experience, in the last year and a half, I've been served with three subpoenas for my deposition. And the deuces tecum attached to them in all three of those cases literally said, give me your complete litigation file on, and then there were a list of about 10 cases attached to it. And if
I think that answered my question. Thank you.
10 cases, 10 citations were attached?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
10 citations to?
10 citations.
To opinions were attached.
No, 10. The deuces tecum said, give me your complete litigation.
In 10 different files.
In 10 different files.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third clause. We take one more recess. And be back.